Hello, welcome everyone to another episode of the O Word Podcast. I'm your host, Corey Elijah, and today I am joined by a very, very special guest, Isaac Wallner of the Human First Project. Isaac, thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
Come talk to us, man. Of course, man. Of course. This has been a long time in the making, I'd say. We first connected, I'd say, last year, a little later than this time, probably say around maybe June,
yeah, June
or so.
Around June.
June or so. After, you know, there was the whole George Floyd protest that went on, and that sparked a lot of activism in the community. A lot of it, in my opinion, kind of got overshadowed by the huge stuff that went on. But there was a lot of work that was being put in by activist groups like the Human First Project, as well as some other people locally in town, trying to just galvanize people, put out the message of unity, especially with the Human First Project, putting out like the verbiage of, hey, we're all human first before all of this other wild stuff.
Correct.
So before we go deep into the project, what got you into, you know, activism and getting out, trying to galvanize people for, you know, for a fantastic mission, let's get into who you are, you know, your background. Are you locally from Kenosha, or like what? Let's go back to little Isaac.
Okay. Well, I was born and raised in Pleasant Prairie. Well, born in Kenosha, raised in Pleasant Prairie. Mm-hmm. And I'm adopted. So my parents adopted six children. We're all from separate families. Mm. So none of us are biologically related. Mm. We're all just one big melting pot of a family. Mm. So really the true American, the American dream, what America was set up on was what my family became, was getting a bunch of people, running a country. My parents kind of did that dream, but in their home. Mm. So, and so being, my parents are white. Mm. I could throw out that's something that people are like, whoa, your parents are white. Yeah, they're white. Mm. And so I had that upbringing by white parents, but at the same time though, we still were in touch with our African roots. So we still had that kind of upbringing too. They didn't pull us away from that. Mm. So we still had that. We were still able to be in touch with who we were. So, and then when went to school here in Kenosha, all school, went to, graduated from Ruther. Mm. And went to Indian Trails first, then just that wasn't for me. So kind of got lost in that school. Mm. And then went to Ruther, graduated from there, and worked a multitude of different jobs. I'm a man of many different hats when it comes to the employment field, because it's just the way it happened. Mm. And I'm currently driving semis.
Oh, nice.
Go to Buffalo, New York twice a week.
Oh, snap. Oh, man, that's a drive. I just got back from the Smokies.
Okay.
And I drove the entire time. And I'm like, man, my knees and stuff. So, man, that's a, I'm sure you get paid pretty good. That's one of like the, it's a kind of a big topic kind of going on right now, especially with like the whole electric switch and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like the, you know, transportation industry is like a huge sector of our economy. And it's a good paying job.
See.
You know, so how did you get into that? You just by, you know, by chance, or you were like, man,
back in, I think it was like 2010, I got a job at a summer camp. Mm. Up north. And I was a camp counselor before though, when I was in high school.
Okay.
And that was a nice camp, summer camp. I went up north, and this summer camp had like mice running around in the camp, in the counselor's room.
Mm.
You know, it was just a gross place.
Mm.
And I was like, yeah, I'm not doing this. So I packed up and I head out, and I stopped in the Dells. Mm. On the way just to have just a rest and just rethink and recalibrate. And I was online. I was like, I need to do something. So I looked up flight school.
Mm.
And truck driving school.
Mm.
And I chose truck driving school. So it was just an on-the-whim thing.
Mm.
I hated it at first. Went to school, got my CDL, got a job at Schneider, hated it.
Mm.
I didn't like it, so I just stopped doing it.
Mm.
And years went on, and I was like, you know what? There's tons of money in this. So I can sit here and keep struggling, or I can actually just use my license that I paid good money to get.
Mm.
And actually get out there and work. So I just got back into it about 2 years ago, and been doing it ever since. So,
oh man, that's what's up, man. Like, yeah, and I imagine that's I mean, it's not a job for everyone, I imagine. I mean, it's like long hours, you're traveling and stuff like that. But I mean, I seen you doing like a podcast from the truck at one point in time.
Yeah,
you know, just being able to, you can talk. There's so many different mediums, and especially like being in like the pandemic era, as I mean, you're in a truck with just you or one other person, mm-hmm. you know, it's like you're not really interacting with people face to face too much, I'm sure, and you're making good money to do it, and people need stuff because everybody else isn't trying to leave the house, so there's some job security there.
Yeah, absolutely.
For a little bit. So, man, that's awesome, man. Yeah, I thought about truck driving like younger in life, and I was like, man, I like to drive, but I'm like a convenience driver. Like, I like to drive when it's convenient for me. Otherwise, like, most of the time you'll find me like on my skateboard mm-hmm. or something like that, because it's just like I can get there without having to drive, so I just won't do it. But that's, I don't know, that's just like a weird nuance of mine. But man, so growing up in Kenosha, I mean, it is like a melting pot of a city. And I imagine it probably was kind of, there was some rough times growing up, especially being in like a blended family in like the 90s, you know, the early 2000s. You know, my background isn't exactly the same. I was adopted by my grandmother. But I spent a lot of time with my godmother as well, who's, you know, she's an Italian lady, you know. So, like, really, you know, she was pretty white, you mm-hmm. know. And she would, like, bring me to, like, the grocery store and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I just remember, you know, at times there being, like, awkward, like, whose kid is this?
Yeah.
Why do you have this child with you? Like, you know, awkward stuff like that. So how was that kind of, like, especially, I imagine, being in a group, you know, you said there were six of you, right? And correct. You all come from different families, backgrounds. You all, you know, look different and stuff. So what was that like, kind of just growing up? You know, not even necessarily like the passive-aggressive or the microaggressions that you may deal with, but like even like school and stuff like that, growing up and being in a blended family, being adopted and stuff like that, you know? Because, I mean, I've dealt with things, and that was being adopted by my grandmother is like, that's one thing, you know? It's like, that's my grandma.
Of course.
You know? But being in just like a, you know, like a true melting pot of a family, which is especially at that time, you know, probably way out of the norm. So how was that growing up and dealing in like school and stuff?
It was I lived in a predominantly white neighborhood and went to a predominantly white school, especially elementary. Mm. We were like the only people of color in that school. Mm. So you had to, I mean, as younger children, you didn't really get much of what you would consider abnormal behavior right. towards our skin color. You didn't really have that. Mm. But as I got older, when it came to, like, for example, fundraising, this is what sticks out the most. Mm. Walking around my neighborhood, we'd be knocking on doors, and I have a background in sales, and I started at a young age, just always wanted to sell something, get something out there. Mm. So I'm persistent. Mm. So I remember walking around, knocking on doors for fundraising, and at first they opened the door, but then eventually they would just ignore us. And there were some people who wouldn't even come to the door at all. And we would stand there and watch. And other children who were not black would knock on the door and they open it. Mm. They wouldn't open it for us. Mm. So that was my real, like, when I think back, that was my real first taste of racism. Mm. Is as a child, when black children knock on the door, they wouldn't open it. And then moments later, a white family comes to the door and they, no problem, buy their stuff.
It's like, people are home? Like, what are you, like, what is, man. Yeah, like. And it is those little things, you know, that you don't, especially as a kid, like my first, like, real time that I felt like I was dealing with race was in middle school, you know, because like you said, like in elementary school, it was, I mean, there's things I could think back on that is like, you know, like randomly not being able to go to like miscellaneous people's houses mm-hmm. when everybody else could go for some reason, you know, when it's like, your parents have never met me before, so I don't know why they would say I can't come over there. But, you know, but as a kid, you're just like, you know, you don't even think about that. But then, like, I feel like it was middle school when everybody was, like, on the cusp of being, like, a full teenager and having older friends that were influencing them. And then bringing that to, like, school and emulating how older people would act and stuff like that was the first time I was really hit with that realization, you know? And for me, it was a situation where I came at because all of my friends were white, but that was because I came from a school where there, you know, it was like me and there was one other in my fifth grade class, one other black kid, you know? So it was, you know, it was like I was friends with him too. But when you go to middle school, then you go kind of go off in your separate ways, you know?
Correct.
And the people that happened to retain my friendship, at least close friendship at that time, happened to be white because they lived on my block. Or, you know, they lived two blocks over from me. And we played all summer and we were waiting for school to start to walk to school together and go to school, you know? And then being hit with that, you know, the realization of, oh, I should have people, I should have friends that look exactly like me solely for the fact that they look like me, was like a weird, a weird thing to have to deal with. So how was it for you, you know, maybe getting a little bit older, maybe seeing things like this? And maybe it was never anything, you know, to you, because everybody's path is different. Everybody handles things differently. But was there ever a situation where you're like, man, like, my family is mixed, and it's not that I don't like them, but I'm getting all this outside pressure because of things that I can't control. Did you ever
have that? Yeah, I experienced negative behavior, negativity from both sides, from people that look like me and people who didn't. You have the people who are like, oh, well, we don't really want to be your friend, or you can't like come to our house and stuff like that. And you're like, well, why? And then once you get older, you realize what it was. But at the time, you're like, you just get sad and you pout and you get over it. But then when it comes to people who look like me, I was always told that I wasn't black enough, or you were raised by white parents, so you're not really black. And it's like, well, I am. Right. So I got that a lot. So you had that. So then you had a sense of not belonging. Like you didn't. Like you were in your skin, but you didn't really feel like you belonged in it, because no matter where you went, I guess nobody really wanted you in per se. So there's definitely that negativity that went on, but eventually you just learned to roll with it. Eventually you found people that looked like me that wanted to be around me, and you found people that didn't that wanted to be around me. And eventually when I got to high school, if you're in high school, it got a lot better, which is weird to say, but middle school is just rough. That's just the age group. In high school, it did get a lot better. I went to ITA, which is a pretty big melting pot of a school. So everybody there was just kind of, it was a lot better there. But middle school and elementary school were pretty, that's where I experienced a lot of that different aspects of what people would consider that influential racism, where their kids just mimic what their parents do.
Right, yeah, it's almost as if like, things were more compartmentalized in middle school than in high school, because I feel like once you get to that like 10th grade kind of age, and it's even like freshman year, you start to like come out of your shell to become you. But in high school, it's like, all right, who am I? I want to go down the path of seeking who I am. And until then, you've kind of just been like an emulation of your life experiences, things you've done, mimicking your parents or mimicking what you see on like TV or in movies and stuff like that, you know. Even like I could even feel it, maybe even like in like my freshman year of high school, there was still kind of a part of me that was like not truly me, trying to be someone that I thought I was supposed to be because of outside influences,
right?
But then once I was like a 16 or so, then that's when I started to really start to like look in at myself and be like, man, I don't care about most of this stuff. Why am I doing these certain things? So, man, I think that's great, man. And that's kind of some of those parallels is why I wanted to have the conversation with you, because like I said, like we have a similar background in a way, but not necessarily parallel. Like it's still different, you know. But we still have both dealt with, you know, growing up, being adopted, regardless of who you're adopted by, having like those questions in your mind, like, why am I in this situation?
Yeah.
Seeing all of your, you know, peers growing up, some of them in single family homes, some of them with both parents, but still, you know, with at least one of their parents at home. And then feeling like, I can only speak for myself, but at times feeling like, why am I an orphan, and not really having like real answers. And as you get older and stuff, you know, you maybe you have some of those conversations. Maybe you look back at some of the situation, or you kind of become content with the situation and realize you are who you are. But coming up, growing up, how was it for you dealing with that? Because
my biggest why that like what I struggle with, and I still do to this day, I think it'll be a lifelong struggle, is when you're in school and they would ask you, like, how did your parents meet? I would tell them how my adoptive parents met, which are mom and dad meet now. I was born at a week old. They had me since I was a week old, so that's the only parents I know.
Right.
But then they'd be like, oh, that's not your real parents. How did your other parents meet? Then I'm like, okay, now they want to know that story. And for me, that story is my biological mother was 14 when she had me. But she was mentally challenged and had the mental capacity of a 6-year-old, and she was pregnant. So that's, I don't have that happy story of I was brought in this world by a violent crime. And so I struggled with that identity crisis for the longest time. Like, why, like, that's how I was brought here. Like, I wasn't really wanted. I was just kind of forced upon somebody, and here I am. So growing up with that it was a struggle to realize that, like yeah, people have accidental pregnancies, but it wasn't a violent crime. So, but then people struggle with that too. Like, well, you guys really want me? It was an accident. What? So you have those people that are out there that struggle with the fact that they weren't per se wanted. They were dealt with per se, and eventually, you know, they were raised and loved, but initially, they weren't necessarily wanted. But being conceived by a violent crime by it's hard, especially as a child. Especially once you learned, I don't know what age I found out the truth behind my conception, but I know I was still a child. And then having to deal with that was my biggest why was I conceived this way? Why didn't I have a normal, a normal story? Like, hey, my parents met here, they fell in love, they had kids. That was my why. You sit there in school and you hear all your friends say, well, my parents fell in love and they just had this whole story, they're high school sweethearts. I'm just like, well, I can't tell you. I can't say that story because that's not true. And before I found out it was, I don't know. Like, I didn't have an answer. It was just, I don't know. They're like, well, how do you not know? I'm like, I don't know. I'm adopted. That was always my answer. I'm adopted. I can tell you how they met, but that's it. So it's almost like you had almost two separate lives, if you will, especially being brought in at a week old. That's the only parents you know, but you know you have another set of parents as well. That you had to try to explain to your friends when you're such a young age.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate because, you know, kids, unfortunately, being thrust in that situation, or just however the cards are dealt, you know, this is the hand that you have, right? And regardless of how you feel about things, you have to play the hand, right? And it's just, it's unfortunate. But it's just, you know, I suppose it's a fact of life. People are inquisitive. People are always going to want to know. There's always going to be someone that's going to be prying and want to ask you questions, even if you're a little kid asking another little kid. And it's unfortunate that, you know, kids have to deal with these pressures.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's something that I imagine. I mean, I don't see things like this being spoken about often, at least not in the mainstream, you know. And for me, you know, just a lot of the things that I personally have dealt with, you know, or had to overcome that other kids don't want to never even think of, you know, certain little things in your life or certain things that might, you know, make you feel down or certain questions that you have in the back of your mind. And then trying to get through life, you know, as normal as possible. Kind of having this thing scratching at you, these questions that you want answered that, you know, maybe you can have answered, maybe you can't have answered, or maybe will be answered later in life when you're of age or old enough to deal with these certain things. And that's why, like, personally, like, one of the biggest things that I love advocating for, and, you know, I always want to be involved in is helping kids, especially kids that are, you know, less fortunate, that mm-hmm. are in situations where, you know, whatever may have happened, they're looking for families or whatever it may be, you know. What are some of your goals, I would say? I know, you know, I want to get into the Human First Project, but I can kind of tell, maybe, and maybe it's not, but I can kind of tell by some of the things, like you say, you worked in a summer camp and things like that. I feel like maybe you have some of the same goals or some of the same things because of your story that you kind of feel like you want to deal with as well. Is there certain things, especially for like less fortunate kids, that you see in the pipeline for you, or even something you've done in the past?
I worked at a summer camp. I also worked at a boarding school in Texas as well. Hmm. It was a Christian boarding school, and it's for at-risk youth or kids who just couldn't thrive in their home environment. Hmm. They need to go somewhere else so their parents can hit that reset button, they can get the help they need and the counseling they need, and they can all come back together with their own individual counseling to, you know, get back to that lifestyle where they can all thrive in the same household. So, and I always been, like, I'm a youth group leader in Kenosha as well. I do mission trips and I do teach Sunday school. So I've always been involved in the youth. When I was 17, I got that job at the summer camp. That was my first job. Mm. So I've always worked with youth throughout my course of my life. And my goal is to, I want to adopt for sure. I feel the need to give back and give children a home that don't have one. And I don't, like, a lot of children age out of the foster care system. They never had a permanent home. And to me, that's devastating. That's, it's not right. There's plenty of homes in America that can, that they could take a kid. They just won't. Mm-hmm. Or they don't have the knowledge. It's not talked about enough. It's not, people don't push it. They don't, yeah, you see billboards every now and then, but they push things that don't hold as much weight in the sense of helping humanity more than they do things that would help humanity and help better people's lives. And adoption and foster care is one of those things. It's a beautiful thing. I don't know where I'd be right now if I wasn't adopted. I just don't know. Who knows the life I would have chose or how I would have raised or even be alive right now. There's no telling. I do know, though, that before I was taken out of my home, when I left the hospital, I lost weight after birth. When I was taken by the police, I was skin and bones. So if I would have stayed there, I probably wouldn't have made it past much a month old. Maybe. That's just, you don't know. But I was in pretty bad condition when I was taken by the police. So, and adoption saves lives. Foster care saves lives. Even the, you know, kids being ward of the state temporarily until they find a home, that saves lives. The problem is it shouldn't stop there. They should find a home. So it needs to be more people willing to open up their homes, even if it's just for a short time. I don't like the kids bouncing around, but even if it's just to get them out of an institutional type setting into a home, even if they do bounce around, hopefully the more people that are willing to get out there and open up their homes, even if it is temporary, maybe one day they'll be like, okay, let's actually adopt one, adopt the child. I don't want to see him bounce. Once you get him in it, I feel like, I know I heard other people, they got into it just temporary. Like, we're going to do it temporary. We don't want to adopt. No. We just want to, at least we'll do it temporary. And eventually they started adopting. Because they just, once you start the process, it's hard not to, you get attached, you bond. And it's hard. Like, I remember being a kid, and my parents fostered numerous kids besides who they adopted. And I was the one room that didn't have another sibling in it. So I always got the kids that came in and then would leave. So then I remember being devastated, even as a child, because I bond with that new kid. And then all of a sudden, my mom's like, they got to go. And I'm like, no, they don't. I remember being pissed at my mom one time, yelling at her, screaming at her. I locked my door so they couldn't take the child away. And I was not letting that child go. So I can imagine being an adult, if you get in that foster care system, how do you let that child, if you have an opportunity, if you can't financially afford it long term, I get it. There's no judgment. But even then, you bond. It's like, well, we can afford this. Let's make a way. So I think if people just dabble in it, put their foot in it, go to a class, learn about it, and more people advocate, so they have that knowledge. So that's one of my goals, is really to advocate, get out there and share my story, share my family story and say adoption does save lives. Adoption does help youth. There's so many youth out there that don't have a home. And if they do have a home, it's not a safe home. And we need more people willing to step up and rise up to the occasion to give these children a home to live in, because no child should ever feel like they don't belong somewhere. So definitely that. And when it comes to my how it was conceived, there it's a taboo to talk about being conceived. You don't really hear people talk about that. Nobody really says, hey, by the way, unless the conversation leads to like how your adoption story. That's why it was brought up here. I'm open about it now. Before I wasn't, but it's, I just wonder how many people are out there in the world that have a similar story that they just box it in. Right. So I do want to start an organization that centers around that, that brings people together who have similar stories that are conceived by rape, as well as the people who gave birth to these people, these children, adults now maybe, that way they can all have a network to share their stories, lean on each other, get resources to not internalize what somebody else did to somebody else and own that. Because that's what I did. I owned their negative behavior. And it ate me. I internalized it, and then I fell in depression, and it wasn't good. Right. So, but who do you turn to talk to that? Nobody brings it up. It's very taboo.
Right. Exactly. And especially, it's hard enough to have hard conversations that aren't that hard.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to open up about certain, lots of things in life, especially something that, you know, I hate to say extreme, but it's an extreme situation, yeah. You know, something that dark, to unpack that with someone when I imagine it's hard to even deal with yourself, even just having to think about it at times, to actually verbalize it to someone else. I imagine it's one of the most difficult things you could do. But having a network of someone with a similar life experience that has gone through those things, and we've seen, you know, it shouldn't be a taboo idea, because I mean, we see it happen with all different types of stuff. Mm-hmm. Whatever, you know, whatever kind of situation you have, there's typically an organization. I mean, a lot of them have national organizations, yeah. You know, pushing them, where you can call, there's a hotline where you can get on, they'll connect you with someone. There is a, you know, a center that you can go to, or there's meetings you can go to, stuff like that. So that's definitely something that, I mean, and it's, you know, something that you're bringing to fruition whenever it is anywhere down the pipeline. You always know that you'll have my support.
Absolutely.
I'm with that 100%, because, I mean, I haven't really got into, you know, the situation why I was adopted, but at some point I'll probably speak about it.
Of course.
But I mean, I found out within this last year, you know, and because of a turn of events that happened in my life, you know, not being able to finding things out and not dealing with them properly, right? And casting, not necessarily judgment, but having, you know, anger kind of because of a situation that's outside of your control. The path that it leads you on can lead you on a path where, you know, you might really regret some of the decisions that you end up making just because you find out the truth, you know? And being, if I had someone that I could have leaned on at the time, you know, with a similar life experience, you know, it would, because it's hard to talk to people that aren't going through the same thing as you. You know, I'm sure people come to you for advice and stuff all the time. People come to me for advice and stuff all the time. And I mean, luckily I've lived a life. I'm not a super young man, so a lot of the time that it is something that I've actually experienced. But sometimes people come to me with stuff that I've never experienced, and all I can do is give you an idea of how I would handle it. But even then, I'm not even really telling you truly how I would, because I don't know, because I haven't walked those shoes and been forced to make that decision, you know? So dealing with, you know, the information that I, you know, was revealed to me, I didn't know how to, you know, I was upset. I was furious, when I shouldn't have been, you know, looking back at the situation, I shouldn't have been, because I am who I am because of the situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? So, you know, like I said, that's definitely something that I would love to help out with, because, you know, kids, you only get one chance to be a kid. And a lot of kids, sometimes they end up messing up their childhoods because of cards they were dealt that were outside of their control, that they react to in a negative way, when, of course, you react to it in a negative way. Right. But, I mean, the system is the system, and you get swallowed up in it. And, I mean, it may not only destroy your childhood. In some situations, we see it can destroy a kid's entire life, you know? So anything that I can do, like you said, adoption, that's definitely something that I have in my sights in the future. I have some kids right now, but my plan is, once they're grown and they're gone, then to help other kids. And with the space that they had, now that, you know, once they get out of my house, fill it up with, you know, with more, you know, and keep it going and, you know, paying it forward. Because, you know, even though I was adopted by my grandmother, who knows, you know, what would have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, you know, and maybe I would have been adopted by someone else, and maybe I would have had a great life, you know. But I have other siblings, too. So, you know, by the grace of God, I'll say we were able to be kept together, and I know my family. So, I mean, for a lot of people, you know, I should have never been as upset as I was, because, I mean, it could have been a lot worse. I could have been in Oregon somewhere working on a farm, not knowing any,
you don't know.
You know?
That's so, the thing. Like, I don't, like, the thing, like, knowing your siblings. I have, that I know of, two biological brothers. I had a biological sister that died after birth, shortly after. So, to my knowledge, she had more children when she got older, because they're younger than me. So when she got older and was more competent mentally, she had more children. How that, I don't even know the story behind that, but I remember I had visitations when I was a kid with, you know, the state order visitation, stuff like that. But then as you got older, those just naturally stopped. And I was working at, well, I was at Walmart with my friend, my best friend, and I was like 18. And we were at the old Walmart on 52nd Street, and we were in the video game section. He's like, "Hey, look at that girl over there." And I turn, I'm like, "Okay, we're, you know, admiring her beauty." And then all of a sudden I hear my name from that direction, from the woman standing next to her. I'm like, "Who are you?" And it was an African American woman. And she's like, "Isaac." And I'm like, "I don't even know who you are." So I'm just going to turn around and just keep doing what I'm doing. She's like, "Isaac." And I'm like, "Okay, now I got to acknowledge you." She's like, "I'm your aunt." And I'm like, "No, you're not. My aunts are white." And she's like, "I'm your biological aunt. I'm your mother's sister. Never met her before in a day in my life. But I guess I look like my mom." And
genes, man, will do it.
Yep. And that girl was my cousin. So then I turn around and smack my friend. I'm like,
"Hold up."
I was like, "That's my family." So, and then, and that's how I kind of got introduced to that my biological family, was through that encounter. And then that led to, I was working at Verizon in the mall at Regency at the time, the kiosk. And one day my manager was like, "Hey, your mom's here." I'm like, "No, she's not. She's at home. I just left." She's like, "No, your biological mom is here." They knew the story. And I was like, "I haven't seen her since I was a kid." And so my first reaction was to run. And I'm like, "I'm just going to take off. I don't want to do this right now." But I'm like, "You know what? You only get one. You don't know. People aren't always here every day. Like, one day they can be gone." So I'm going to take the moment, this opportunity. And I started talking to them. We ended up getting led around to I met more family. Found out that I had family that I went to school with. And now I know why we never got along. We butted heads because we were biologically related. I didn't know. I didn't realize how big my biological family is in Kenosha. But I know some of it now. Not all of it. Just some of it. But I went to school with some cousins. I had no idea they were cousins. But then my biological mother passed away a few years ago now. She had breast cancer. and she was 35 and she passed away. But I'm happy I took that opportunity to meet her as an adult. Otherwise, I would have never had that adult memory. Yeah. It would have been, I don't even remember the visitations as a child. Most children don't remember those moments. So I'm happy I took that moment to do so, because if you don't, you're gonna, you always have that moment. You have that regret. Like, if you have the opportunity, some people don't. So they don't. So yeah, they're gonna long for that moment, but they never had the opportunity. They didn't have the choice to say no. Yeah. So they can't own that decision because it was never theirs to have. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want to have to own that. So I thought about, like, I don't want to have to. So what something happens, I never get a chance to say hi to her. I decided to say no. That was my choice. Mm. So that's why I decided to engage with her and talk to her and just get to know the woman who gave me life. Because that's still an important part of my life. Without her, there'd be no me.
Right.
So, and she, there's nothing negative about her. Like, yeah, I was adopted, and yeah, there was, you know, I wasn't fed when I was, you know, like I mentioned earlier, when I was a week old, I was skin and bones. But given the circumstances, they did the best they can do. And there, my biological grandfather stood up in court and told the judge that they wanted my parents now to adopt me. So he vouched for them. So they loved me. There was no doubt in my mind. They just couldn't take care of me. They didn't have the resources. But that's love, when you know that we can't do this, so help us. That's love. So to help children navigate their adoption story is also, that's a goal. Like, this is the whole thing, like, this adoption, not only for advocating, like, come adopt children, but to the children who are adopted, to help navigate their story, to navigate their feelings, you know, to figure out, how do I live my life with all that I've been dealt with? Like, my life gave me this, I don't know how to decipher this, I don't know how to decode this, I don't know how to live this, how to feel about this. There's so many adoptions, and it's good, but there's, for the children being adopted, there's so many feelings and thoughts, and just trying to walk through the cards you were dealt, and handling your story. And as you find out more and you get older, it's like tearing the Band-Aid off again. You gotta try to find a way to put the Band-Aid back on and deal with it. And I know I got a phone call probably like 8 years ago now from my biological brother. That's when me and my mom were talking, and he was like, hey, and he's like, I got in trouble with the police. I was like, okay. I'm like, talk. And he's like, he harassed me. I was at my foster home. It's in a white neighborhood. And I hit him. He just got out of hand. And I was like, well, he's like, what do I do? I'm going to court. I'm like, be honest. That's all you have is your honesty. If you hit him, tell him why. Tell me you're afraid. Just be honest. That's what you have for you. And whatever happens after that happens. But as long, but you know in your heart you were honest. So I had to be a big brother to a brother I don't even know. So I got thrown in. It was pretty rapid. It was a rapid descent. I met them, and all of a sudden it's like, welcome to our family. I'm like, wait, what? I have one. Not that I don't want to know you guys, but it's so quick. It happens so fast.
It's strange. I'll just be real. It is strange, right? Like, because you live your entire life, like, it's kind of an awkward situation, yeah, to be a full grown adult, you know. Like me recently, no, not as recently, but over the past, within the past decade, the better part of, I'd say, like, 6 or 7 years, I've recently met some siblings that I have. And I'm 32. I'm going to be 33. So I'm a grown man.
Right.
You know? So I believe I was 25 or so when I met some of my older siblings. From my dad's side. Like I said, like, I don't know my dad. It's a funny situation to me, because, like, I was even, like, I know that side of the family now. So, like, my grandmother had passed and everything. It's a whole thing. I went to the funeral. I'm going to say this publicly, and maybe someone will relay this to him so he will feel however he can feel about it. But I went to my grandmother's funeral to pay respect, even though I didn't really, you know them that well, that side of the family, but it was still my grandmother, you know, and it's still my family. You're still correct. Part of me. So I go, and he was there, and it was like, I'm not going to go out of my way as a grown man. At the time, I was like 30, I think. It was a couple, like 2 years ago. So to me, I'm like, maybe I should like go introduce myself to him. But then also, as a grown man, I'm like, well, I've lived my entire life, and clearly you are in range enough to, if you wanted to know your kids or whatever, you would reach out or whatever. So to me, it was just like, I'm going to play, see how this goes. Maybe he'll say something, maybe he won't. Regardless, I'm not going to feel like I reached out and got crapped on.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Or something like that. So it didn't happen. It is what it is. But my siblings from him that I've met are very, very cool. Like, one of my brothers is into, like, a lot of the same. So if people come into the office, you can see I have, like, comic books and, like, collectibles and action figures and stuff. He's into the same thing. So we went to C2E2 last year. Hopefully we'll go to another con soon, you know. And we kind of been bonding over that situation when my mother just passed recently, my biological mother. So my older sister, she's been reaching out to me, and she's just making sure I'm good and stuff like that. And like you said, having these conversations with someone, like, I don't know her that well, you know. I know her a little better now, but it's still like, I was just like, man, well, I feel good that you're reaching out, and you know, it's like, this is great to have, like, especially like, I've only had older brothers. I have a little sister, so I never had like an older sister. And, you know, women are just, they have that maternal instinct, you know. So she's so caring and loving, and just was giving me advice, saying, like, if you need anything, reach out, you know. And it's like, that little stuff, it's like, it is kind of like, oh, man, like, this is different because, like, I'm an adult. And those bonds are typically something that, you know, you kind of, like, grow together to have, like, those right. little sibling bonds. But it's still a bond where it's like, no, like, honestly, the last time she called me, it was like a situation where I shouldn't have even taken a phone call, but I took the phone call because she was calling to make sure I was okay. And even though we didn't grow up together, even though she's a little bit older than I am, like, we still, like, she still cares. And like, it's that part of life where it's like, it doesn't matter when you actually really meet. You only really have like that, you have that connection that's always gonna, you know, have you linked to these people.
Right. Yeah.
So embrace it.
Yeah.
Because there's so many people in the world. There's so many people that you're not connected to, that you're not linked to. So many people that you wish you just knew their story, you know? So when you have an opportunity to be connected to someone, especially seeing like parallels of your life with their life sometimes, like, I'm just like, oh man, like, hearing, you know, some of like, just, or seeing some of the mannerisms, or like hearing some like inflections and stuff, I was like, man, we all related, huh? That's super crazy how that works. So, man, it's a wild thing.
It is.
But I mean, I wouldn't trade my hand for anything, because I've had some ups, I've had some downs, but I've had some really, really good times, man. And I know you have too, especially with a lot of the stuff that you got going on. Last year was crazy. Yes. But I mean, there was a lot of progress that was made. There was a lot of connections that were made. Yeah. A lot of people that I didn't know that I do know that I'm glad that I know now as well. What got you out and about, you know? Was the catalyst the George Floyd situation?
George Floyd. So, full disclosure, I want to be a police officer. I want to be my whole entire life.
Okay.
Since I was a little kid, I tried enlisting into the Marines out of high school. And I was a little overweight at the time, and they're like, "We'll work out with us. We'll do PT. We'll get you down to your weight, and then we'll get you out of the boot camp." I'm like, "Cool." So I was working out with them like 5 days a week, and I dropped like 70 pounds in like 4 months just to get in. And I got a denial letter instead because I was born with one kidney, and that's a denial. So I got pissed off at the world and started just eating whatever I wanted to eat. I was like, "Screw this, screw that. I don't want to do anything in my life. That was my dream." And then, so, you know, I was like, you know what? No, I can you know, instead of fighting the war overseas, I can be a police officer here and take care of home. So there was always a dream, just never turned out that way, at least in my 20s. But after having that ambition to want to do that, and then, you know, knowing the racial disparities in our country and the, you know, the police brutality towards people of color in our country, mainly black people, it really angered me to go from, you know, seeing things that happened like Michael Brown before and his other, before the social media kick of Black Lives Matter and that big swing we saw on social media, you still had the protests. I remember Ferguson burned down. So you still had that, but you didn't have the coverage that sparked the worldwide revolution. It was a different time. So I think things, the spark that I saw, because when George Floyd was killed, I was driving semis for J.B. Hunt at Meijer. I was on the Meijer account. So I was, and that was, you know, right when COVID was still at its peak. So I was running busy. We were trying to get toilet paper to all the stores. we were trying to get toilet paper and bleach and wipes. That's what we were doing. We were just running like crazy. And I always remember like this little side story, just trying to, just praying just for the people that I go to, I get my load. I'm like, hopefully there's toilet paper in here. Open up and it's just regular stuff. It's gross. I'm like, well, that's not what they want. They don't want. Well, yeah, they want it, but they want toilet paper. Because I remember going to one store, I had a whole 52-foot trailer full of toilet paper and hand sanitizer and bleach wipes. It's all that was on there. I delivered it to a Meijer in Illinois. I backed my trailer in, got out to get my paperwork signed. I ran to the bathroom. By the time I got back from the bathroom, they were already unloading the trailer, and they had it on the sales floor. The people rushed it. I didn't even get to pull off from the dock yet. And people were already buying the toilet paper. Like, it was like the second hit the sales floor, they couldn't even get off the pallet jack. And they were just tripling and, you know, the whole car full of toilet paper. I'm like, guys, come on now. but back to that. But yeah, so there was just, I couldn't go to any protests with that schedule, with what was going on, being a truck driver. So I was like, you know what? Nobody was making any on my day off. So I was like, I'm just going to make my own. So I hopped on Facebook and I was like, what, let's just type it up, you know, protest, for George Floyd, whatever I had put. I just typed up a paragraph. I'm a writer, so I just wrote something up and hit post event. I was thinking, you know, maybe family, a couple friends will show up. That's what I was thinking. I was like, it'll be small. And all of a sudden, overnight, I saw like 100 people RSVP'd. I was like, okay, this is not small. And like 200 people, like, and then 300 people. I'm like, you know what? Now I got to get organized. Like, I wasn't expecting that. And I got to figure this out quick. So I talked to people, got speakers, got some clergy members, and I was like, now they need to hear me. So I'm like, I don't want to do the megaphone. I want louder sound. So then I rented speakers, a PA system, and ran with it. Went out there and spoke and had my speakers speak. And from that day on, I was like, you know, I can do this. This is something I can do. I can organize. I can pull people together. And I like to speak. Before that, before the events, I wasn't really a public speaker. I'll talk all day, you know, in a more of a intimate type setting, but nothing like that. I mean, at boarding schools, I talk in front of all the kids, but even then, you got to know them. It was still a more of an intimate setting. Right. Just to a mass crowd, I can barely even get my grandmother's eulogy out at her funeral in front of family, because I just didn't like to speak in front of, I didn't really know all that family. So when I didn't know you, I got more clammed up. But after that, I was like, you know, this is my passion. This is for to stop the racism towards black people. So that just ignited a flame that can't be put out. And just getting out there and speaking and, you know, fighting for change. So after I made that first protest, like, when are you going to do another one? And I was like, this took everything I needed to do this one. But I just started organizing. And I was like, you know, I'm going to keep organizing and, you know, trying to change the narrative that the media portrayed for people who are fighting for black lives as being, you know, they riot and they're negative and they're loud, they're noisy, they're disgusting, they tear things up, they destroy things, they're not good people. I'm like, well, big word, not peaceful. They're not peaceful people. Well, I forced the narrative in Kenosha, and I say forced because I called the Kenosha News and told them, if you're going to document my protest, document what you actually see. Don't spin it. Otherwise, don't. Like, don't show up. So they did. Luckily, I got a good reporter who's no longer there anymore. And he documented it the right way. And as you said, this was a peaceful protest. There was no violence. There was no unrest. It went off peacefully. And that's so to have that media portrayal of what we are actually really doing without somebody spinning it for news and for money, for profit, was a good thing. Because we were like to stay in the fight we're in, we need as much positivity as possible. That way we garner more people. So I wanted to make sure that, you know, even if somebody came in our faces, you know, somebody was racist and just started saying all kinds of obscenities that like tell people like we're greater than this, we're gonna rise above this. Because we're not gonna let them take us to a place that they want us at and then ruin things. So just trying to create an environment that people can come out to and feel safe at and, you know, protest, but at the same time know that if something happens, we all got each other's backs. We're all in this together. And other people were doing that, not just me, I was the only one. I just couldn't go to any, so I was like, you know, I gotta make my own. It fits my schedule. Yeah. And hopefully people come. Yeah. And they did. So
yeah, and I think for all of the events, I'll speak specifically for your events, they've all had good turnouts, and they've all been exactly what you wanted them to be. Even the one around the time of the Jacob Blake situation, where they had like the fence erected around the courthouse and all of that, you had the boot on from your foot.
Yeah, yourself. I broke my ankle. Boot.
Yeah, we were still taking laps around the courthouse and stuff like that. Everyone being peaceful, but you know, just showing, you know, highlighting, you know, the cause and why people are out there, but remaining peaceful. And like you said, I mean, if it wasn't for a lot of the work that had been put in before, like the, you know, everyone from around the entire world came here, that they may have been able to spin the narrative the way that they were trying to, yep. Right? But there had been weeks prior of peaceful event after peaceful event after peaceful event after peaceful event, even events where there was protesters and counter-protesters that ended in a way that was not near how, you know, no. The media was trying to portray how things were going on. And of course, things got wild. We're not saying things didn't get wild.
Of course.
Definitely a bunch of things that I will never co-sign did go down. But again, that was at like the peak of, I mean, there was so much outside influence really just trying to create a narrative for Kenosha that wasn't Kenosha, you know? And unfortunately, I mean, you know, but think people are going to involve themselves in things if they're seeing stuff happen, right? Correct. And I think that's a big thing that's kind of going on right now with, you know, a lot of like arrests have been made and stuff like that of people that have been involved. Mm-hmm. So now they're trying to force this other narrative saying, look at all these people that are from Kenosha that caused all this stuff, right? But again, we have to look at the track record of everything that went on, right? These wild crimes, there was crimes that were happening in Kenosha, yeah. that was completely separate going on. Like there was a lot of gun violence and things that was going on. That was completely separate from any kind of protest or anything that was going on. And in just my opinion, it kind of felt like all of the negativity that was happening within the city was being, and why this was happening, I don't know why it was happening, but it seemed to be all equated under like the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is miscellaneous people from Illinois coming up here. There's gun violence in Simmons Island and all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And somehow the protesters, somehow a negative light got shown on them throughout of it. All of that, and that was another reason why, you know, I wanted to like consciously take time and make sure like I was out and highlighting and documenting what was going on. It's like we can see what's happening. People mm-hmm. are marching, people are yelling. You may or may not agree with what they're yelling, but they're not doing anything that's not legal right now. This is all peaceful. There is marching. There's even some situations that were even organized by kids, by high school kids.
Yeah.
You know, so this narrative that was organically created by actual people and not being spun for clicks or any of that stuff, was a peaceful narrative. And I've been just for weeks after, you know, months now, after everything is almost a year, after everything is, you know, happened, I still find myself saying, hey, like, check the record. I didn't erase anything that happened. You can look and see the weeks of all, you know, all the peaceful stuff that happened, a situation that bubbled out of control and quickly retracted and turned right back to what it was before everyone was here. More peaceful protests, mm-hmm. organized by citizens that want to see us take things in the right direction. Yes, some people may agree, some people may disagree, but how things are being handled in a cordial way. You know, we're having conversations, people are getting out in the streets. But there was a lot of fear that was kind of kicked up throughout all of this. And I kind of want your take on why do you think that is? What was your feelings throughout all of this going on too? Because as an organizer, you know, you're setting up events that are getting eyes, you know, like people are showing up. Lots of people are showing up. It's not like, hey, I'm doing this event, you know, 10, 15 people are showing up. It's like, no, there's hundreds of people that are showing up to these events at times, you know. So how were you kind of dealing with that? Did it affect your strategy at all? And how do you feel about, like, seeing how peaceful things were and seeing, like, yeah, things got out of hand that was completely outside of all of the normal organizers' control? But as soon as we reined things back in, things went back to normal, but it seemed like the fear never dissipated.
No.
So what's your take on that?
I think, you know, the whole fear part of things, without getting overly political, the Chicago Tribune interviewed me, and I had a front page article on the Chicago Tribune about the political aspect of this and being what is driving the former president's campaign. How is he trying to win these cities over? And that was out, there was a commercial on TV, which is all ties in, of Kenosha. It was a campaign for Trump. It was a video campaign that just had a woman laughing in the background. It's a sadistic laugh. And then Kenosha on fire. And then instead, this article is paid for by the Trump campaign. And that, I'm like, that was their strategy. And then, so I feel like that fit that whole, you know, the Democratic grand cities are destroying America and we need to win this election to save America. That was the fear mongering. That was spiking up fear and then taking away, well, attempting to take away from the fight for Black Lives to Matter, the fight for equality, was no, they're not really asking. They want to destroy the police department. They want to dismantle and defund the police department. They want to take away our rights. Like, that, they were just, that fear mongering was, it was an attempt to hurt us, an attempt to really kill our efforts and to take the country away from American citizens. It just doesn't make any sense. It's everybody's country. We should be able to coexist without all these problems. But there's a clear divide that we saw last year, over the past 4 years. There's a very clear divide that was drawn in the sand. If it wasn't clear before, it's clear now. And then you have, on a local level, you can start to see a divide between local politics and other people, whether it be business owners that made their stance very clear where they stood. People weren't afraid to speak up anymore. Whatever side they were on, they weren't afraid. They came out the closet to push their agenda, to make sure that we knew, or vice versa, which is fine. It's a free country, freedom of speech. You do what you got to do. But my problem, where I had a problem with it is, if you're going to speak freely, speak the truth. If you saw a protest that I had, for example, and I was out there bashing, you know, white people and breaking the city, report that. I'm okay with that. That's the truth. But don't spin it just to get clicks and just to push your narrative.
Right.
So that's what angered me throughout the whole course of the summer was, you would have an event, and somebody would say comment that out of passion, out of maybe anger for what happened, and then on the front page of the news is that one comment that was off-colored. Mm. Out of all the good things that happened, they picked that one individual comment to tarnish and muddy the movement. So so you're fighting a lot of opposing forces in the media, in the city, that don't want to see the movement progress in the way it was progressing. So we gained a lot of traction. We gained worldwide traction. And when you have something that, like you had George Floyd in Minneapolis, we stood up with George Floyd in Kenosha. Then it happens here in Kenosha to Jacob Blake. And then so now the world is starting to catch on. So this is traction that they were not expecting. So I feel like when we're going up, they're here to say no. Like, we're going to do whatever we can to knock you back down some levels. But what I am proud about, though, is we were able to control a lot of that narrative. We were able to fight back and say, you know, especially in the day and age of live streaming and video, even if it was just camcorders, because that's still saved. You can put it in the tape player and play it later. But live streaming is now, it's instant, so people can see it now. They don't have to wait for a tape recording later. Right. I think that really helped control that narrative, is to say, hey, this is what we're seeing. Now, at that point, you could take it for what you want to take it for, but this is what we see. This is what's going on. This is the event. There's an event here tonight. I'm here recording it, whatever, and you can watch. If you don't want to be there, you can see it. Now you know. Now it's in your living room. You don't even have to leave your house to see it. So I think that helped, too. So before you had this, the media, before live streaming, cell phone, social media, whatever the media put out there, we ate it up. Like that it is what it is. That's what it is. The media can say that the sky is green, and we'll be like, oh, yeah, it is. I didn't go outside the house, but I believe it. Like, that's just how media is.
Right.
People don't, they read it and they take it for what it is, instead of doing some self-investigating to realize that may not always be the truth, or maybe it is a truth, but it's a skewed truth.
Right.
So to get out there and to see all the fear-mongering by well-known Kenosha people who you were otherwise remain quiet and more in the background, they do their thing, and people knew who they were, but all of a sudden, when it comes time, which that happened on an election year, I think made a big difference.
That's one thing that I kind of wanted to slightly interject about, right? Because, and to be as, and I try to remain apolitical, like I'm, you know, I see what happens. I'm looking at the facts. I know people have agendas and stuff, right?
Of course.
And one of the, and just kind of bringing it back to the live streaming and taking back the control, right? One thing is narratives on both ends are shaped, right?
Mm-hmm.
And controlled in a certain way. But the live streams not only protects... It not only protects the individuals, but it protects movements in general, yeah. Right? And it also it holds people accountable at the same time, because people on the opposite side of the spectrum, an argument that you hear a lot of the time is people are just using you, right? The Hegelian dialectic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Problem, reaction, solution, right? So it's like, we have the situation. How can we mold this situation to benefit us perfectly, right? And especially happening in an election year and seeing how there was a lot of support. There was an outpouring
for sure
of support. A lot of support that maybe without the situation being as horrible as it had been would have never arrived, right? So, and as someone that's like, I'm trying to be fair to everyone, you know, throughout everything, I was trying to be fair. A lot of questions I found myself posing, and it's really something that you can't be answered until after the fact is all of these people, are they really saying this because this is how they feel, or are they using this as an opportunity to benefit this situation that's going on? Because mm-hmm. It was a very, like, it's, we have to admit, like, as a strategist, to not utilize the situation in a way to help benefit you would be completely ridiculous, right? If it's like an underhand softball, yeah, where it's like, well, dang, you might as well just said I win.
right.
But after you win, you have to remember all of these things that you said. So just bringing it back to the media and the live streams and us recording everything that has gone on and even, you know, writing speeches and having like the transcript of the speech that was written, where people after the fact will go take a sentence of it and clip it and try to frame it in a way, or take a situation that they said, oh yeah, we're gonna do this, and then it's like, yo, all right, well, we have you on record in the heat of the moment with all of this stuff going on, when you had all of these people around that could hear what you're saying, saying all of this stuff that sounds really, really good. It sounds great. Now it's time for you to, you know,
it's time for you to deliver.
So I think this year, out of like after, like just the aftermath, is even more interesting to see how things continue to play out, you know? Yeah. Because, you know, people are feeling a lot more comfortable now, you know. Some people are, some people aren't feeling comfortable. Some people are, you know, there's still a lot of signs and stuff. I was in Nashville and I was like, man, I swear the election was in November. There's still a lot of these signs up.
There are.
It is what it is, you know. But if you paid for the sign. Rock your sign.
Yeah, when I drive to New York and through Pennsylvania and New York, there are signs up everywhere.
Right.
They'll line farm fields for like 2 miles. I'm just like, guys, like.
And it's like, yo,
this is what it is.
If you want to spend your money on this, yeah, for sure, we know how you feel.
You do. Know?
It is what it is. That's what's up. It's America. You can do whatever you want, right? But it's interesting to see how things play out and where things go, because people have kind of like recited, there is high energy. There is very, very high energy until like the second week of November. And then things started like, and I mean, it's gotten cold, you know, I'll admit that. And it's springtime. It seems like people are starting to, brace themselves or get prepared to get back out and, you know, march or whatever, you know, get organized, especially with situations that have gone on recently and stuff, you know. But I'm just interested to see how things play out, you know, just because. And that's not locally. This is generally just speaking on, you know, the massive attention and the people that tend to like to puppeteer narratives, you know, coming in. And again, it's like both sides are going to do it. All seven sides are trying to puppeteer the narrative, you know.
Yep.
But it's interesting because it's like we have this new age activism, new age media pairing themselves with activism and just entertainment and media in general, right? Like creating a brand new scope and a brand new way to kind of consume things and a brand new way to kind of filter out what you feel is like, oh, this seems too establishment. I probably can't really trust this. Even though you're smiling and your hair, you know, your haircut's cool, I still don't really trust what you're saying. I'd rather go to someone's Facebook profile or whatever it may be.
Correct.
Because I know they're going to shoot it straight and they're not going to chop it up and they're just going to let it be what it is. So moving forward with the project, the Human First Project, 2021, what's the goal?
The goal for 2021 is to, now that the name's out there and there's awareness towards the project, I want to put a center, if you will, here in Kenosha, kind of a headquarters. And out of that headquarters, I want to start to, the project is to really, kind of like the synopsis, you know, no matter what color you are, you know, who you decide to love, the money you come from or not come from, no matter what walk of life you are, what that makes you, that makes you an individual, you're a human first. You deserve equality, love, respect, the American dream. It doesn't matter who you are. Mm-hmm. Everybody deserves it. And as there's a lot of oppression based upon those individual traits that make us who we are. And my goal is to take the fight some of that oppression by providing resources through this resource type center, such as mental health resource. That's a big one. Our mental health is really who we are. And when you're dealing with oppression and lack of resources, your mental health declines rapidly. And I want to be able to provide low cost or free mental health services, you know, to keep it free for people who are low cost, who are low income, depending on your income level, will determine where you fall on that scale. Mm-hmm. If you can afford a little bit, that helps people who can't afford any. So it'll be a sliding scale just for the sake of, you know, making sure I can get everybody who needs it done. Mm-hmm. But trying to partner with people who are willing to offer that, who are psychologists and who are able to offer that service and want to work at an organization that provides that. It really, though, that Kenosha is a community. We're a community. We need to trying to get people to get that community mindset in a whole, not just a group of people, not sides, but trying to get the community to come back together again to help each other out. Because if we can fight what we all know is, whether you believe it or not, we all know what oppression is. We've seen it. Now we can turn a blind eye to it. They're just making it up. But people are smarter than that, what they lead on. They just don't want to, they don't want to admit that they know, because then they put on that facade that it's not real, because they don't want to care. So I want to fight that. I'm like, no, this is real. You can care and still have your separating politics and what we need as humans is kind of where that goes into. It's like you can push aside your political beliefs and look at this human who needs help, who is suffering, who's going through this. Whether you're a Republican or Democrat, we're human first. Right. Whether you're black or white, we're human first. Whether you're gay or not, we're human first. Transgendered or not, we're human first. It doesn't make a difference. We're all human at our core, and we deserve everything this country has to offer. We shouldn't have kids going to school hungry. We shouldn't have people who are living on the street homeless. We shouldn't have people who can't afford mental health care. They're like, well, take care of your body, eat healthy, eat this, go to school. But your mental health care, it's like there needs to be a bigger push for that, because then we can take care of our body, we can't eat healthy, we can't, you know, be successful in school, be successful at our jobs, maintain healthy relationships, maintain, you know, married homes, and maintain families that don't split up and break apart. We can do those kind of things. We can better our community. We put a push on the things that oppression's taking away from a lot of our community, black, white included. So the goal is to get a resource center going that's going to fight oppression is really the goal. And then eventually, once I gain more traction and gain more funding, I want to start populating those centers around the country. Nice. And then one thing I'm working on too is, this is in the future, far in the future. There's an organization called Mercy Ships. They take old ships and they build floating hospitals, and they're off the coast of Africa. They provide free surgeries. My goal is to work on finding a way to create a ship that is a water production company to take the salt out of salt water and provide water to these third world countries. I want to house it out of the Human First Project and take it on a global scale one day and try to find a way to do that.
That's what's up.
And use people in college who need a project for their degree, who are chemists, stuff like that, to all butt heads and just be like, how do we do this? How do we get the equipment? How do we make this water clean? Because the ocean's a huge, beautiful resource full of water. Right. How do we harvest that and make it so we can give these people water who need it? Then how do we get the water from the coast of Africa to the middle of the, you know, but there's ways. If there's a will, there's a way. Right. There needs to be a will. And so I want to use, you know, the local stuff, you know, eventually the national centers as a platform to a global platform to provide other things to other countries that need resources, stuff like that. So
that's what's up, man. Hey, that's, you gotta have the big goal with the smaller goals so you can tack them on top of each other to get to that big one. And I definitely feel that, man. That's awesome, bro. And I mean, it's also like a question raising thing too. It's like, and I think about this stuff with some of like the miscellaneous things that pop up in my mind. I'm like, yo, I am legitimately a regular person, right? And if these ideas pop up in my mind, there's no way that people with tons of resources don't think about this type of stuff. So is, are they trying, or are they just like, but I like having the control of the little bit of water that we do, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you think, like, people who have, if we just take the top three richest people in the world, just the top three, that's it. Not even the rest of the numerous millionaires and billionaires out there, and just put their resources together, the great they can do, if they got out of their comfort zone, because in order to rise up, in order to, like, start an organization, you have to get out of your comfort zone. You can't just be in your little bubble and expect to break open organization, because you're going to get doors slammed in your face. You're going to meet resistance from the new communities that don't want it or don't agree with you. But that's okay. That's all part of activism and organizations. You're going to meet resistance. Think of Martin Luther King Jr., for example, going out there and fighting. He was, there was resistance the whole entire time, but you have to keep knocking on that door. It's like kids who go out, it's like fundraising, for example. Keep knocking on the door, eventually somebody's going to open. Eventually, because they're going to be like, what do you want?
Someone wants some chocolate, man. I know someone wants some chocolate.
See? And so you keep getting out there and pushing that, we want good. We want better. We're not asking for, and this goes even for equality, because that's what the organization is all about. We're not asking to take your rights away so we can have our rights. We just want our equal rights, our equality, you know, our right at the American dream, a fair shot, not a shot that's been tied up in racism and, you know, systemic racism for years. Like, oh, you guys have a shot, do we? You know, and that goes for, you know, male versus female, for example. It's a lot of things that female, that woman cannot accomplish, or if they can accomplish it, it's having to lift a 1,000-pound weight while the male gets to lift a 1-pound weight to get there. Like, why do they got to carry that weight in their back just because they're a woman? They shouldn't have to. They should be able to have a fair opportunity at that dream they're chasing that their counterpart that's male does. So there's all these different walks of life that are affected by man-made ideas and thoughts and hatred that we put upon each other that does not need to be there. Because all we're doing is making life much more difficult. We were all able to succeed without having to carry different size weights on our backs, I like to call it. I use the weight on the back kind of concept. You know, if you're a woman, you might have to carry this, like I said, a heavier weight than the male does. If you're black, heavier weight than a white person does. You know, gay or not, transgendered or not. Like, you all have, there's weights you have to carry that are heavier than the person next to you who is not who you are. And it shouldn't be that way. And we shouldn't want it that way, because if we were all able to succeed fairly, we'd be in our country would be a much better place. There'd be more profits, more money, more, like, we'd all be able to thrive a lot better. So I don't know why we don't want that. That would help everybody. Like, people who, like, the rich people who want all their money. Well, if all your employees were taken care of, regardless of who they were, their religion, what they look like, you'd make more money. So a lot of,
especially if you're like a company that, like, makes stuff, like technology companies and stuff, like, man, like, if you sell cell phones and you give me more money, I'm probably going to buy that new cell phone that you launch when it comes out, especially if I'm trying to sell it too, you know. You know, it's just how it works, you know.
Like, if you work at a hotel, it's a good example. People who work at a hotel can afford to stay in a lot of hotels they work in. You pay them a good wage, and it's time for vacation.
They're staying in that hotel 100%.
Yep.
Because they know how it works. They know the amenities. They know, like, they're I mean, that's what I would do.
Same here.
And they probably get a little discount, but you know for sure that they're going to use your hotel. That's more income.
Yep.
Even if it's at a... People do sales all of the time. Even if it's at a slightly less margin,
yeah.
You're still getting
income. You're making money.
It's still profit. So, man, Isaac, man, before we close out, man, is there anything else? Did we miss anything, man?
The weight loss surgery.
How has that been, man?
The weight loss surgery, I'm going to say, people always ask me, was it worth it? So the day of surgery, after the surgery, I woke up in excruciating pain. Because, I mean, they go in, it's laparoscopic, so robots.
Okay.
And I had like 7 incisions on my stomach where they cut me open, little incisions. But the pain, because it's a gastric sleeve.
Mm.
So they if you think of a banana shape, they cut your stomach about the shape of a banana.
Oh.
And it's tiny. It holds about 1 ounce after your surgery.
Oh, dang.
That's all. So after the surgery, I was allowed to eat this blended parade food, like liquid first, then parade food. So smoothies, you know, blended up vegetables, like baby food, if you will.
Mm.
And then I can slowly graduate. Now I'm on regular foods.
Mm.
My stomach holds about 3 to 4 ounces when it's healed,
mm.
which is what we should eat, but we don't eat that way.
Mm.
People, we just eat.
Yeah, that's a whole another conversation
is.
About honestly, I don't even eat breakfast half the time.
I didn't either. I skipped it.
And people are like, "What do you mean you don't?" It's honestly, for a while, I was going in over the past, I'd say 2 years, I got a grasp of life and overcame some stuff, and I was like, "Yes, I'm gonna eat less because there's no need for me to be eating as much as I was eating." So,
right?
Yeah. So yeah, man.
See, for me, the biggest thing was my depression was what caused my serious waking. Like I said, in high school I was a lot smaller, but over my depression, what came to dating women, failed relationships, depression, suicide attempts. I turned to food. I was an emotional eater. So I went through about 10 years just a depressive type. Never diagnosed, but just being down. Life got the best of me, and that was just enough for me. And I turned to food to eat. I would skip breakfast. Usually I skip lunch. I didn't want to eat. And at nighttime I'd eat. And I just eat. And people are like, "Well, how do you not eat all day?" I'm like, "Because when I do eat, I have to eat enough calories for my, I'm hungry. My body, and then everything I eat, my body retains.
Right.
Because I wouldn't eat all day.
Right.
So even if I had, eggs and a toast, all the calories I hold on to. Because I didn't eat because I didn't eat all day. That was my how I ate when I was depressed.
Mm.
I skip lunch and breakfast and lunch, eat at night, then go right to bed.
Right.
So that was my problem. So after the surgery has, got me to a place now where I look at food differently.
Mm.
Food is no longer something that I turn to when I'm having a bad day. Food is now a nutrition. That's all it is.
Mm.
There's joy. And, if you go out to a restaurant, which I do, but it's still, I look at it as I will have leftovers.
Mm.
I'm like, I don't have to try to find a way to eat it all now because it's so good.
Mm.
I'm going to take some home with me.
Mm.
But so far, I started the journey about last August. No, it was after that. It was about November-ish when I started the journey, and I'm down 77 pounds.
Oh, wow. Dang.
Since the surgery, January 29th, I'm down
53. Okay. Wow.
So,
So it's moving.
I finally got, my highest weight was 470.
Mm.
I'm down to 393.
Ooh.
So I'm finally out of the 400s.
Mm.
I call it the 400 club. I'm out of it.
Mm.
Now my goal is got a 300 club. So
nice. It's
moving along. It really is. Clothes are fitting looser. I'm down a pant size, a couple pant sizes, and it's going good.
That's what's up.
So I'm excited because
I can only imagine, bro. That's awesome, bro. Like legitimately, that's awesome. And when I found out you were having the surgery, I was like, "Oh, dude." Dude, set. Because I know you have the passion behind you. I know, when you have a goal, you're, at least from as far as I can tell, when you have a goal, it's set, and that's what you're going to do, the whole thing with the Human First Project. You're like, man, I just want to get out there. This is what I want to do. Even if I have to organize it on my day off, this is what I'm going to do. Dang. How many people are coming? All right, let's take this serious. It takes a certain mindset. And maybe it's, you know, the things that the depression and the stuff that you overcame in your life experience, you know. And I find now that I'm in my 30s, like, I'm making better decisions.
See, same here.
You know, it's like things are a little clearer, you know. When you're in your 20s, you're kind of just like, I'll be like this forever. It doesn't matter. I can just do whatever.
Yep. There's no consequences. It'll just, but then you hit, like we said, when you hit 30, it's like, wait a minute. I got to button down, like buckle down now, because we're not getting younger by any means.
Definitely not. And the work is harder.
And I think
the work is harder, but it's more satisfying. It's you get more of a reward from it, I feel.
And that's the lesson I learned from the surgery. Not only the weight loss, because the pain is ridiculous after surgery. I don't take pain meds. I hate pain meds. I don't like taking medicine like that. I never been that way. But I actually caved after the surgery and took some pain. Only for like a day. I refused the first day. My mom came over and she was like, I already know, take them. And I'm like, no. She's like, if you don't take this medication, I can see it in your, because she came over and I was just on the couch. I didn't even look up. And then she walked in the door. I was like, I don't even, nope. I'm looking at you. I'm in too much pain. She's like, you didn't take them, dude. I'm like, I know I didn't take them. They forced me in the hospital because I know I'm not taking them. I have control now. I'm home. And she's like, if you don't take those medicines, I started taking them for like 2 days just to appease her. And then I stopped. But I mean, it was so bad that, like, I remember dropping my cell phone. And I just left there. I couldn't even pick. You can't bend over for like 3 weeks.
Oh, man.
You can't. You can barely sleep. You can't bend over.
Oh, man.
Like, I dropped my phone and I was like, nope.
You're just down there.
Huh? Yep. I don't need you. So and I eventually I got the courage to bend over and pick it up. And that was a mistake. Something like popped in your stomach. It was just the pain. Like, cause they take part of your stomach away. So that's all cut open. That's all raw, and it's just. But that's what you learn though through that pain though, which is a life lesson. Through the pain that you're going through, wherever it may be, there's always greater at the end. If you get through that pain, it's like climbing a mountain. It's painful. It's like working out. It's like a surgery, breaking your ankle. You gotta rock through the pain. You gotta ride through the pain. To get good results, to get to your goal, to achieve what you want to achieve, to get through your depression or your sorrow. It hurts. But at the end, though, there's a great reward. But you have to push through it. And you can fall down a couple. Like, there's days where I was just like, nope, not even getting out of bed, not living today. I'm going to lay here and just not doing it. But I'm like, I have to. I have to find a way. I'll give myself a day to do this. One day just to mope around. And feel sad. It's okay to feel sad. People are like, don't throw a pity party. Throw a pity party one day. It's okay. Just make sure you don't stay there. Bounce out of it. Try to find a way to climb out. Whatever it is, go for a drive. Go for a walk. Whatever. Hop on your skateboard. Whatever it may be. Find something that makes you happy to pull yourself out of that. Because in that pity party, we think like that. That's like people use the term pity party, but for me, it's more of a deep state of thinking. That's where a lot of people go when they're that sad. They just think and they reminisce. Sometimes we need those thinking days just to be like, what am I doing? But don't stay there. Now figure it out and just get out. And then now what you thought about, make it happen. So yeah, riding through that pain was, I didn't want to do surgery because I was like, you know, I'm giving up. That's why I felt, I'm giving up. But realistically, it's just a tool. My brain didn't change. They didn't operate on my head. They didn't change the mentality that got me overweight. That's all still there. So I can still choose to overeat and re-stretch my stomach out and ruin my surgery. I have that option. But I had to change my thought process. It's not, the surgery wasn't me giving up. It wasn't me cheating. I still had to change this. And that was hard to not want to have a bad day. And like, especially with the climate right now with the police shootings, to want to just go, you know, be depressed in a plate of food. I don't do that. I can't. I can, but I won't, because I know where this is taking me, the greater things. So I'm going to ride through fighting my cravings, fighting the things I want to go back and turn and do, but because I'm fighting that because I know where it's taking me. I see the bigger picture. I see the end results. So. That's